Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1080, Surveillance Valley Part 6, Double Agents Part 2, subtitled Foxes Guarding the Online Privacy Hen House Part 3. This is being recorded on July 23rd of the year 2019. Well, the title of the program tells us many things. First of all, this obviously is the sixth program in this series. And obviously, we are talking about individuals and institutions and technologies, many of which are beloved by the internet community and enjoy excellent reputations. And with regard to some of the organizations, it may well be that many of the people involved with them are sincere. And even if one makes them aware of the fact that the organizations with which they are affiliated are in fact not only compromised, but actually functioning in effect as double agents, they might be inclined to reject that. It is, as I believe it was Upton Sinclair noted, or perhaps Sinclair Lewis, it is difficult to get someone to understand something when keeping their job depends on their not understanding that. That kind of cognitive dissonance in play has a lot to do with an awful lot of things. Nonetheless, there are some of us who from day one took a look at Snowden's ride, as I called it, the adventures of Eddie the Friendly Spook, and saw the wall-to-wall coverage and the lionization of Eddie Snowden and the fascist WikiLeaks network as basically being exactly what they were, foxes in sheep's clothing, or wolves in sheep's clothing, and foxes guarding the henhouse. I'm mixing my predator metaphors here. Suffice it to say, and we'll talk about this maybe in our next program by way of review, 95% of what Snowden had to talk about in his, quote, revelations had been known for a long time. It also is standard operating procedure by all other NATO countries. The recent flapdoodle about Huawei and 5G, etc. And it may very well be that Huawei does perform internet espionage technologies. It is at best hypocritical because all of our technologies, the privacy activists, the networks, and the tech companies themselves are absolutely complicit with surveillance. The internet was invented by the Pentagon, and it was not intended as a wonderful device for communication and the spreading of truth and the enlightening of humanity. It can be very useful. I have mixed feelings about it. It enables me to do a lot more than I could before. I can put entire books online, as I have with the Spitfire list books for download. I can communicate with the entire world, but it is certainly monitored and monitorable, to coin the term. The internet is an information weapon. Its purpose is counterinsurgency. It was developed as part of a group of overlapping Pentagon/DARPA projects that included the developing of Agent Orange. Okay, we've spoken about this in our early programs. Tools like the Tor network and something we're going to talk about in this program, the Signal app for smartphones, are fundamentally compromised and, in fact, have been developed by and are promoted by double agents. People like Jacob Applebaum, funded by the BBG, a subsidiary basically of the CIA, organizations like WikiLeaks, whose website was in all probability the greatest data mining operation in history, not only Bibit used the Tor network, which, as we will see, was not only totally transparent to the very intelligence services it supposedly was going to keep out, but it also has deep security flaws which will permit anyone with the requisite internet skills to penetrate it. And the WikiLeaks site was hosted on the Pirate Bay website financed by one of Europe's most prominent fascists, Carl Lundstrom. One of Julian Assange's fascist assistants, Joran Jermas, a.k.a. Israel Shamir, a Russian-born Holocaust denier, arranged for WikiLeaks to hold forth on the Pirate Bay website. In talking about the entire crew, Assange, Snowden et al., David Duke serves as something of a trace element, as I have spoken about in many of the programs. Suffice it to say that not only was WikiLeaks a data mining bonanza for intelligence services, but for the fascist international as well. When people went on the WikiLeaks website, the fascist international and the intelligence services were able to determine just exactly who they were and in what they were interested. So, notion, wow, you know, WikiLeaks, it's so far out, and hey, this is a wonderful new anti-government, anti-surveillance operation, baloney. Julian Assange is a fascist gangster. He is a believer in eugenics. He has a long history of associating with Holocaust deniers, white supremacists et al. He was enthusiastic about WikiLeaks being hosted on the Pirate Bay website, again, financed by one of Europe's most prominent fascists. By the way, Carl Lundstrom was associated with Daniel Freiberg. It was Richard Spencer, with whom Daniel Freiberg was associated. Robert Spencer runs the Jihad Watch website, a good anti-Muslim Brotherhood website. Richard Spencer is the alt-right person who is now partnered with Daniel Freiberg. I earlier mentioned that Lundstrom had arranged a Scandinavian speaking tour for David Duke. That was an error due to the Google translation. It was actually Freiberg, an associate of Carl Lundstrom, who arranged a Scandinavian speaking tour for David Duke. Joran Jermas is part of a milieu that is hooked up with David Duke. Eddie the Friendly Spook, Snowden's first attorney, a guy named Bruce Fine, was the chief legal counsel for Ron Paul's 2012 campaign. And Ron Paul has been networked with David Duke for decades and is joined at the hip with the Neo-Confederate movement, which basically believes that slavery was justified and that the South should do it again. One of Ron Paul's top aides is a guy named Walter Block, who has a concept he calls voluntary slavery, which, as I have noted in the past, is not only the ultimate oxymoron, but perhaps the ultimate in collateralized debt obligation. And Glenn Greenwald, who was the face of much of this, is basically, for all practical purposes, a Nazi lawyer, although he has gained his, quote, progressive, unquote, street cred. He has a history of running legal interference, not only for Nazi and white supremacist killers, but perhaps more significantly, he did much to guard the leaderless resistance gambit against the possibility of interdiction by civil suits, not criminalization of free speech, but civil litigation. These people, Assange, Snowden, Greenwald, Applebaum et al., are the antithesis of what they represent themselves as being. Andrew Auernheimer, a.k.a. Weave, the web architect for the Daily Stormer and someone who appears to be behind the hacks, unquote, of the Macron campaign attributed incorrectly to Russia, was a guest at the party that Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras held to celebrate their receipt of the Polk Award, a prestigious award to investigative journalism. Citizen 4, Porges's documentary, a very obviously studied effort, got an Oscar for documentaries. And with the accolades heaped on these fascists and white supremacists and people who are joined at the hip with the neo-Confederate movement, advocates of slavery, they are the antithesis of what they represent themselves as being. But how now can all of the journalists who say, oh, my goodness, you know, Eddie Snowden, that's so great, and oh, my goodness, WikiLeaks, that's so great, and oh, my goodness, you know, Glenn Greenwald, gee, what a great guy. How can they now turn around and face the truth? As the brilliant political comedian Mort Saul noted in his autobiography, Heartland, Mort Saul, one of Jim Garrison's investigators, how many lies before you belong to the lie? Again, it is very difficult to get someone to understand something when keeping their job, or perhaps extending that, maintaining their professional prestige and standing depends on their not understanding it. To understand this and many of the things that we have spoken about and will speak about, please get a hold of and read the book Surveillance Valley by Yasha Levine. I get no money whatsoever from this, and I will reiterate that while I would not say this is the most important book I have ever read, I will state without qualification this is as important a book as I have ever read. And beyond that, I think that people in today's world, past a point, will find it impossible to truly understand our civilization and the world in which they live without reading this book. Again, Surveillance Valley, subtitled The Secret Military History of the Internet by Yasha Levine.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Now, in our last program, we took a look at things like the Arab Spring, the antithesis of what it was represented as being. It was one of the color revolutions designed to bring corporatism to the Arab and Muslim world. Specifically, Ibn Khaldun, the 14th century economic icon of the Muslim Brotherhood, was a focal point of the quote Arab Spring, really the Muslim Brotherhood Spring. And note that the bloodbaths in Syria and Libya were direct outgrowths of that. Key names: BBG, the Broadcasting Board of Governors, a CIA derivative. Also, OTF, the Open Technology Fund, run by the BBG, basically a CIA derivative. The Tor Network, developed and promoted by these same elements, and as we will see, the Signal app as well. What we're going to look at, and we thought we had some of this near the very end of our last program, and that is how, following the success of the Arab Spring, basically, again, a color revolution, a covert operation, and embraced with open arms by the so-called progressive community who just thought it was great. And, of course, the key factor in a lot of that is ignorance of the Americans, the so-called progressive sector as well. Basically, we're manifesting Orientalism. They know nothing about Egypt. And their knowledge of Egypt and the Arab world in general is the rough equivalent of one of those old cornball 1930s and 1940s travelogue movies. Our next stop is Egypt, land of the pharaohs. Parenthetically, the pharaohs are ancient history. First, we'll take an authentic camel caravan and visit the pyramids. After that, we'll stop at a desert oasis, eat fresh dates, drink refreshing spring water, and be entertained by an exotic belly dance performed by the lovely Scheherazade. I mean, that's about the kind of clown A blank blank S blank 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 that is housed between the ears of the average American, including the so-called progressive sector as well. after the relative success of the Arab Spring, there was a major funding of, quote, Internet Freedom Technologies, really the use of the Internet as a vehicle for destabilization. Turning to Surveillance Valley by Yasha Levine. In early January of 2014, 6 months after Snowden's leaks, Congress passed the Consolidated Appropriations Act, an omnibus federal spending bill. Tucked into the bill's roughly 1,500 pages was a short provision that dedicated $50.5 million to the expansion of the U.S. government's Internet Freedom Arsenal. The funds were to be split evenly between the State Department and the Broadcasting Board of Governors. Although Congress had been providing funds for various anti-censorship programs for years, this was the first time that it budgeted money specifically for Internet freedom. The motivation for this expansion came out of the Arab Spring. The idea was to make sure the U.S. government would maintain its technological advantage in the censorship arms race that began in the early 2000s, but the funds were also going into developing a new generation of tools aimed at leveraging the power of the Internet to help foreign opposition activists organize into cohesive political movements. The BBG's $25.5 million cut of cash, more than double the agency's anti-censorship technology budget from the previous year, and the BBG funneled the money into the Open Technology Fund, a new organization it had created within Radio Free Asia to fund Internet freedom technologies in the wake of the Arab Spring. Initially launched by the CIA in 1951 to target China with anti-communist radio broadcasts, Radio Free Asia had been shuttered and relaunched several times over the course of its history. In 1994, after the fall of the Soviet Union, it reappeared Terminator-like as a private non-corporation wholly controlled and funded by the Broadcasting Board of Governors, again, a CIA derivative. Continuing. Now, with the Open Technology Fund, or OTF, Radio Free Asia oversaw the funding of America's Internet Freedom Programs. To run OTF's day-to-day operations, Radio Free Asia hired Dan Meredith, a young techie who worked at Al Jazeera in Qatar, and who had been involved in the State Department's anti-censorship initiatives going back to 2011. With a scruffy beard and messy blonde surfer hair, Meredith wasn't a typical stuffy State Department suit. He was fluent in cyberpunk hacktivist lingo and was very much a part of the grassroots privacy community he sought to woo. In short, he wasn't the kind of person you'd expect to run a government project with major foreign policy implications. With Meredith at the helm, OTF put a lot of effort on branding. Outwardly, it looked like a grassroots privacy activist organization, not a government agency. It produced hip 8-bit YouTube videos about its mission to use, quote, public funds to support Internet freedom projects, unquote, and promote, quote, human rights and open societies, unquote. Its web layout constantly changed to reflect the trendiest design standards. But if OTF appeared scrappy, it was also extremely well-connected. The organization was supported by a star-studded team, from best-selling science fiction authors to Silicon Valley executives and celebrated cryptography experts. Its advisory board included big names from the Columbia Journalism School, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Ford Foundation, Open Society Foundations, Google, Slack, and Mozilla. Andrew McLaughlin, the former head of Google's public relations team, who had brought in Al Gore to talk a California state senator into canceling legislation that would regulate Gmail's email scanning program, was part of the OTF team. So was Cory Doctorow, D-O-C-T-O-R-O-W, a best-selling young adult science fiction author whose books about a totalitarian government's surveillance were read and admired by Laura Poitras, Jacob Applebaum, Roger Dingledon, and Edward Snowden. Doctorow was a huge personality in the crypto movement who could fill giant conference halls at privacy conferences. He publicly endorsed OTF's Internet Freedom Mission, quote, "I'm proud to be a volunteer OTF advisor," unquote, he tweeted. OTF again, CIA. From behind this hip and connected exterior, BBG and Radio Free Asia built a vertically integrated incubator for Internet Freedom Technologies, pouring millions into projects big and small, including everything from evading censorship to helping political organizing, protests, and movement building. With its deep pockets and its recruitment of big-name privacy activists, the Open Technology Fund didn't just thrust itself into the privacy movement. In many ways, it was the privacy movement, one more time. With its deep pockets and its recruitment of big-name privacy activists, the Open Technology Fund didn't just thrust itself into the privacy movement. In many ways, it was the privacy movement. Now, we have spoken extensively about the Tor network. We're going to come back to that and how it is easily penetrated by relatively sophisticated Internet individuals or organizations. However, we're going to talk about another technology that was promoted by Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden. That is the Signal app for smartphones. And just like the Tor network, which, again, got Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden's thumbs up, he also was promoting Signal as well. And just like the Tor network, Signal is fundamentally compromised. And note that Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden, well, we're going to talk more about him, but this is a guy who in 2009, when stationed in Geneva, Switzerland for the CIA, said online, quote, "The elderly, quote, wouldn't be effing helpless if you'd stop sending them effing checks so they could sit on their A blank blanks and lie in hospitals all day." Basically, he's a damn eugenicist, rather like Julian Assange. And he is the opposite of the warm, touchy-feely guy he would have us believe. He's a damn fascist. And it is really ironic with the so-called progressive sector, you know, endorsing the likes of Bernie Sanders and, you know, Medicare for all. And then on the other, with the other hand, they're saying, "Oh, Eddie Snowden, oh, he's so wonderful. I love Eddie." Now, this is again, Mr. "The elderly wouldn't be effing helpless if you'd stop sending them effing checks so they can sit on their A blank blanks and lie in hospitals all day." The clear implication being, get rid of these useless bread gobblers. But that is the way it goes. We talked about Tor. Now we're going to talk about Signal. Back to Surveillance Valley by Yasha Levine. The Tor project remained the best-known privacy app funded by the Open Technology Fund, but it was quickly joined by another, Signal, an encrypted mobile phone messaging app for the iPhone and Android. Signal was developed by Open Whisper Systems, a for-profit corporation run by Moxie Marlon Spike, a tall, lanky cryptographer with a head full of dreadlocks. Marlon Spike was an old friend of Jacob Applebaum and played a similar radical game. He remained cryptic about his real name and identity, told stories of being targeted by the FBI, and spent his free time sailing and surfing in Hawaii. He had made a good chunk of money selling his encryption startup and have worked with the State Department on Internet Freedom Projects since 2011, but he posed as a feisty anarchist fighting the system. His personal website was called thoughtcrime.org, a reference to George Orwell's 1984, which seemed a bit tongue-in-cheek given that he was taking money, nearly $3 million, from Big Brother to develop his, quote, privacy, unquote, app. Signal was a huge success. Journalists, privacy activists, and cryptographers hailed Signal as an indispensable internet privacy tool. It was a complement to Tor in the age of mobile phones. While Tor anonymized browsing, Signal encrypted voice calls and text, making it impossible for governments to monitor communication. Laura Poitras gave it 2 secure thumbs up as a powerful people's encryption tool and told everyone to use it every day. People at the ACLU claimed that Signal made federal agents weep. The Electronic Frontier Foundation added Signal alongside Tor to its surveillance self-defense guide. Fight for the Future, a Silicon Valley-funded privacy activist organization, described Signal and Tor as, quote, NSA-proof, unquote, and urged people to use it. It's hard to read this without laughing, frankly. Again, Schadenfreude in action. This last sentence again, because I had a hard time fighting off the laughter. Fight for the Future, a Silicon Valley-funded privacy activist organization, described Signal and Tor as, quote, NSA-proof, unquote, and urged people to use them. Edward Snowden was the combo's biggest and most famous booster and repeatedly took to Twitter to tell his 3 million followers that he used Signal and Tor every day, and that they should do the same to protect themselves from government surveillance. Use Tor. Use Signal, unquote, he tweeted out. With endorsements like these, Signal quickly became the go-to app for political activists around the world. Egypt, Russia, Syria, and even the U.S. Millions downloaded Signal, and it became the communication app of choice for those who hope to avoid police surveillance. Feminist collectives, anti-President Donald Trump protesters, communists, anarchists, radical animal rights organizations, Black Lives Matter activists, all flocked to Signal. Many were heeding Snowden's advice, quote, organize, compartmentalize to limit compromise. Encrypt everything from calls to texts. Use Signal as a first step, unquote. Silicon Valley cashed in on OTS internet freedom spending as well. Facebook incorporated Signal's underlying encryption protocol into WhatsApp, the most popular messaging app in the world. I mean, this is ironic. In light of Facebook and Cambridge Analytica, we're going to get back to Mark Zuckerberg, as I call him, a little later, or maybe in the next show, depending on the limitations of time. Facebook incorporated Signal's underlying encryption protocol into WhatsApp, the most popular messaging app in the world. Google followed suit, building Signal's encryption into its Allo and Duo text and video messaging apps. It was a smart move because the praise flowed in, quote, Allo and Duo's new security features, in other words, are Google's baby steps toward a fully encrypted future, into the sort of bold moves to elevate privacy above profit or politics that some of its competitors have already taken, unquote, wrote Wired's Andy Greenberg. Quote, but for a company built on a data collection model, one more time, but for a company built on a data collection model that's often fundamentally opposed to privacy, baby steps are better than none at all, unquote. If you step back to survey the scene, the entire landscape of this new internet freedom privacy movement looked absurd. Cold War era, beginning again, Cold War era organizations spun off from the CIA, now funding the global movement against government surveillance. Google and Facebook, companies that ran private surveillance networks and worked hand in hand with the NSA, deploying government-funded privacy tech to protect their users from government surveillance. Privacy activists working with Silicon Valley and the U.S. government to fight government surveillance, and with the support of Edward Snowden himself. Skipping down. In any event, with support from someone as celebrated as Edward Snowden, few had any reason to question why apps like Signal and Tor existed, or what larger purpose they served. It was easier and simpler to put your trust in app and to believe in the idea that America still had a healthy civil society where people could come together to fund tools that countervailed the surveillance power of the state. That suited the sponsors of internet freedom just fine. After Edward Snowden, OTF, read CIA, was triumphant. It didn't mention the leaker by name in its promotional materials, but it profited from the crypto culture he promoted and benefited from his direct endorsement of the crypto tools it financed. It boasted that its partnership with both Silicon Valley and respected privacy activists meant that hundreds of millions of people could use the privacy tools the U.S. government had brought to market. And OTF promised that this was just a start. Quote, by leveraging social network effects, we expect to expand to 1 billion regular users taking advantage of OTF-supported tools and internet freedom technologies by 2015, unquote. And, well, it speaks for itself. Maybe in our next show, I should do, I think, maybe a slight return of my old Eddie the Friendly Spook voice doing some promotions. You know, hi there, boys and girls. maybe in our next show, just due to the limitations of time. Now, I mentioned earlier the Tor network on which WikiLeaks held forth, and it is fundamentally flawed. Now, in addition to the intelligence services that were inextricably linked with its creation, it is accessible to, well, pretty much anyone with the internet skills to penetrate it. It was very penetrable, and it is the safest of bets that with WikiLeaks, in addition to the very intelligence services that were supposedly being victimized by WikiLeaks, the Fascist International was taking advantage of these flaws as well.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Returning to Surveillance Valley. Working under a Pentagon contract, researchers at Carnegie Mellon University in Pennsylvania had figured out a cheap and easy way to crack Tor's super secure network with just $3,000 worth of equipment. He, Roger Dingelbaum, Tor's creator, accused Carnegie Mellon researchers of violating academic standards for ethical research by working with law enforcement. Boy, is that hypocritical. He then announced that the Tor project would publish guidelines for people who might want to hack or crack Tor for, quote, academic, unquote, and, quote, independent research, unquote, purposes in the future, but do so in an ethical manner by first obtaining consent of the people who were being hacked. I mean, again, it is so hard to read this and keep a straight face. What isn't funny at all is what happens to people that venture out and tell the truth. We will conclude our hard discussion of Surveillance Valley by talking about what happened to Yasha Levine. Thankfully, he's still alive, but oh boy, did he get the Jim Garrison treatment. And anyone who questions the integrity of Eddie Snowden or WikiLeaks or Glenn Greenwald or any of these mofos, you get the same kind of treatment. But I love this. He, Dingelbein, then announced that the Tor Project would publish guidelines for people who might want to hack or crack Tor for, quote, academic, unquote, and, quote, independent research, unquote, purposes in the future, but do so in an ethical manner by first obtaining consent of the people who were being hacked, in no doubt. Continuing and skipping down. If it was so frail that it needed academic researchers to abide by an ethical honor code to avoid de-anonymizing users without their consent, how could we hold up to the FBI or NSA or the scores of foreign intelligence agencies from Russia to China to Australia that might want to punch through its anonymity systems, or to the very skilled internet users grouped around Pirate Bay, too, I would add. In other words, forget about it. In 2015, when I first read these statements, and this is Yasha Levine writing, in 2015, when I first read these statements from the Tor Project, I was shocked. This was nothing less than a veiled admission that Tor was useless at guaranteeing anonymity, and it required hackers to behave, quote, ethically, unquote, in order for it to remain secure. Hacking, by the way, is a federal offense. It is the equivalent of mail tampering. It's quite wild. Now, back to Eddie the Friendly Spook. These days, by the way, we have newspeak. There is no such thing as a fascist. As Mussolini noted, il fascismo e il corporatismo. Fascism is corporatism. But now you're either a right-wing libertarian or you are a, quote, populist, unquote, or a paleoconservative. If Adolf Hitler came back to life, journalists would be talking about the German paleoconservative Adolf Hitler, whom critics accuse of pursuing an ultra-nationalist agenda. And Eddie the Friendly Spook is a fascist, and he is a corporatist. Again, in 2009, when he was posted to Geneva, Switzerland by the CIA, and during that summer, he supposedly was stricken by the Angel of Mercy, who breathed the breath of human enlightenment upon him, and newly refurbished with this, Eddie decided to ride out on his white charger and fight the surveillance state, blah, 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 and by the way, ignited the new Cold War when he went to Russia, courtesy of WikiLeaks. Yasha Levine notes Eddie the Friendly Spook's corporatist agenda. He writes, there in Moscow, he came out as a right-wing libertarian. He had already come out with that a long time before that. Snowden hated the New Deal, wanted to shrink the government to the size of a peanut, and believed the state had no right to control the money supply. He preferred the gold standard. He mocked old people for needing old age pensions. Somehow our society managed to make it hundreds of years without Social Security just fine, he wrote on the forum. Magically, the world changed after the New Deal, and old people became made of glass. He called people who defended America's Social Security system, quote, effing retards, unquote. And I'm attenuating this because we are on the radio. He did more than that. Again, in that same thread that I've read on the air, he said, quote, the elderly, quote, wouldn't be effing helpless if you'd stop sending them effing checks so they can sit on their A-blank-blanks and lay in hospitals all day. You know, I hope Eddie the Friendly Spook lives old enough to get old. And I hope he lives long enough to have his body disintegrate. And I hope he experiences this. I really do. And he'll see why people are getting those effing checks, okay? And next, Eddie the Friendly Spook, come to more about his corporatist viewpoint and how he runs interference for the very internet companies that are not only deeply complicit with the surveillance conducted by the federal government, but which themselves rely on the surveillance foundation of the internet, created for the purposes of counterinsurgency. It is a weapon. They use that very counterinsurgency vacuum cleaning methodology or technology for the data mining, which is at the core of their profits. However, Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden, the corporatist extraordinaire, covers this up. And back to Surveillance Valley. In Moscow, while living under state protection at an undisclosed location, he swept Silicon Valley's role in internet surveillance under the rug. Asked about it by Washington Post reporter Barton Gellman, who had first reported on the NSA's PRISM program, Snowden shrugged off the danger posed by companies like Google and Facebook. The reason? Because private companies do not have the power to arrest, jail, or kill people. Quote, Twitter doesn't put warheads on foreheads, unquote. He joked. Snowden's views on private surveillance were simplistic, but they seemed to be in line with his politics. He was a libertarian and believed the utopian promise of computer networks. He believed that the internet was an inherently liberating technology that, if left alone, would evolve into a force of good in the world. The problem wasn't Silicon Valley. It was government power. Again, this fits so nicely into the entire GOP ideological bag. Continuing. To him, cynical intelligence agencies like the NSA had warped the utopian promise of the internet, turning it into a dystopia where spies tracked our every move and recorded everything we said. He believed the government was a central problem and distrusted legislative or political solutions to curb surveillance, which would only involve the government even more. As it so happened, his line of thinking tracked perfectly with the anti-government privacy initiatives that internet companies like Google and Facebook have started pushing to deflect attention from their private surveillance practices. More about Cora Snowden's view of the corporations as the protectors of individual privacy. Snowden portrayed the internet as a scary and violent place, a cyber medieval landscape filled with roaming government bandits, hostile armies, and booby traps. It was a place where regular people were always at risk. The only islands of safety were the private data centers controlled by private companies. Google, Apple, Facebook. I would add Amazon. Didn't mention that here. These were cyber fortresses and walled cities that offered sanctuary to the masses. In this chaotic landscape, computer engineers and cryptographers played the role of selfless, galloping knights and wizard warriors whose job was to protect the weak folk of the internet, the young, the old, and infirm families. It was their duty to ride out weapons aloft and convey people and their precious data safely from fortress to fortress, not letting any of the information fall into the hands of government spies. He called on them to start a people's privacy war, rallying them to go forth and liberate the internet to reclaim it from the governments of the world. Snowden's disregard for political solutions and his total trust in the ability of technology to solve complex social problems wasn't surprising. He was simply reaffirming what he had told journalists back in 2013. Let us speak no more of faith in man, but bind him down from mischief by chains of cryptography, unquote. Ken, it is hard for me to read this without laughing. It is, well, it's what Nietzsche said A joke is the epigram on the death of a feeling. More about the reaction of the big tech firms, and they are shocked to learn about this, including that most disgusting and hypocritical of people, Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook. And in part three of this series, we reviewed Cambridge Analytica, which was the very embodiment of the counterinsurgency and anti-democratic and fascist ethics upon which not only the Internet originally in its counterinsurgency genesis in the early 60s, but the Nazi Party itself was predicated. Returning to Surveillance Valley. You didn't have to be a tech expert to see that the government surveillance on the Internet simply could not exist without the private infrastructure and consumer services provided by Silicon Valley. Companies like Google, Facebook, Yahoo, eBay, and Apple, other than Amazon, did all the heavy lifting. They built the platforms that drew in billions of users and collected a boggling amount of data about them. All that the NSA had to do to get at the data was connect a few wires, which the agency did with full cooperation and total discretion from the Internet companies themselves. Quote, we hadn't even heard of PRISM before yesterday, unquote, Mark Zuckerberg wrote in a Facebook post. He blamed the government and positioned Facebook as a victim. Quote, I've called President Obama to express my frustration over the damage the government is creating for all of our futures. Unfortunately, it seems like it will take a very long time for true, full reform, unquote. Apple, Microsoft, Google, Yahoo, and Amazon all reacted in much the same way, denying the allegations and painting themselves as the victims of government overreach. Quote, it's tremendously disappointing that the government sort of secretly did all this stuff and didn't tell us. We can't have a democracy if we're trying to protect you and our users from the government, unquote, Larry Page told Charlie Rose in an interview on CBS. And again, it's just makes me want to puke. And Yasha Levine, in the main concluding element of Surveillance Valley, sums up this concatenation. And in our next show, we're going to review some elements and also talk about what happened to Yasha Levine. Talking about the compromised Signal app. Then there was the fact that Signal ran on Amazon's servers, which meant that all its data were available to a partner in the NSA's surveillance program, which parenthetically Amazon was. Equally problematic, Signal needed Apple and Google to install and run the app on people's mobile phones. Both companies were, and as far as we know, still are partners in PRISM as well. Quote, Google usually has root access to the phone. There's the issue of integrity, unquote, writes Sander Venema, V-E-N-E-M-A, a respected developer and secure technology trainer, in a blog post explaining why he no longer recommends people use Signal for encrypted chat. Quote, Google is still cooperating with the NSA and other intelligence agencies. PRISM is also still a thing. I'm pretty sure that Google could serve a specially modified update or version of Signal to a specific target for surveillance, and they would be none the wiser that they installed malware on their phones. Equally weird was the way the app was designed to make it easy for anyone monitoring Internet traffic to flag people using Signal to communicate. One more time. Equally weird was the way the app was designed to make it easy for anyone monitoring Internet traffic to flag people using Signal to communicate. or that the FBI or, say, Egyptian or Russian security services had to do was to watch for the mobile phones that pinged a particular Amazon server used by Signal, and it was trivial to isolate activists from the general smartphone population. So although the app encrypted the content of people's messages, it also marked them with a flashing red sign, quote, "Follow me, I have something to hide," unquote. Indeed, activists protesting at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia in 2016 told me that they were bewildered by the fact that the police seemed to know and anticipate their every move despite their having used Signal to organize. Damn, that is amazing. I mean, I just can't figure that out. Can you? Continuing. The debate about Signal's technical design was moot anyway. Snowden's leaks showed that the NSA had developed tools that could grab everything people did on their smartphones, which presumably included text and received by Signal. In early March of 2017, WikiLeaks published a cache of CIA hacking tools that confirmed the inevitable. The agency, working with the NSA as well as other, quote, cyber arms contractors to develop hacking tools that targeted smartphones, allowing it to bypass the encryption of Signal and any other encrypted chat apps, including Facebook's WhatsApp. Quote, the CIA's mobile devices branch developed numerous attacks to remotely hack and control popular smartphones. Infected phones can be instructed to send the CIA the user's geolocation, audio, and text communications, as well as covertly activate the phone's camera and microphone, unquote, explained a WikiLeaks press release. These techniques permit the CIA to bypass the encryption of WhatsApp, Signal, Telegram, Weibo, Confide, and Cloakman by hacking the, quote, smart, unquote, phones that they run on and collecting audio and message traffic before encryption is applied. Parenthetically, since WikiLeaks is operating on the Tor network, of course, everybody who goes onto it to check this out is then compromised not only by all of the major intelligence services, but also by the Fascist International. Continuing. Disclosure of these hacking tools showed that in the end, Signal's encryption didn't really matter. Not when the CIA and NSA owned the underlying operating system and could grab whatever they wanted before encryption or obfuscation algorithms were applied. The flaw went beyond Signal and applied to every type of encryption technology on every type of consumer computer system. Convoluted as the story may be, U.S. government support for internet freedom and its underwriting of crypto culture makes perfect sense. The internet came out of a 1960s military project to develop an information weapon. It was born out of a need to quickly communicate, process data, and control a chaotic world. And today, the network is more than a weapon. It is also in and of itself a field of battle, a place where vital military and intelligence operations take place. Geopolitical struggle has moved online, and internet freedom is a weapon in that fight. If you take a big picture view, Silicon Valley's support for internet freedom makes sense as well. Companies like Google and Facebook first supported it as part of a geopolitical business strategy, a way of subtly pressuring countries that closed their networks and markets to Western technology companies. But after Edward Snowden's revelations exposed the industry's rampant private surveillance practices to the public, internet freedom offered another powerful benefit. For years, public opinion has been stacked firmly against Silicon Valley's underlying business model. In poll after poll, a majority of Americans have voiced their opposition to corporate surveillance and have signaled support for increased regulation of the industry. This has always been a deal-breaker for Silicon Valley. For many internet companies, including Google and Facebook, surveillance is the business model. It is the base on which their corporate and economic power rests. This entangles surveillance and profit, and these companies would collapse. Limit data collection, and the companies would see the investors flee and their stock prices plummet. Silicon Valley fears a political solution to privacy. Internet freedom and crypto offer an acceptable alternative. Tools like Signal and Tor provide a false solution to the privacy problem, focusing people's attention on government surveillance and distracting them from the private spying carried out by the internet companies they use every day. All the while, crypto tools give people a false sense that they're doing something to protect themselves, a feeling of personal empowerment and control. And all those crypto radicals, well, they just enhance the illusion, heightening the impression of risk and danger. With Signal or Tor installed, using an iPhone or Android suddenly becomes edgy and radical. So instead of pushing for political and democratic solutions to surveillance, we outsource our privacy politics to crypto apps software made by the very same powerful entities that these apps are supposed to protect us from. In that sense, Edward Snowden is like the branded face of an internet consumerism as rebellion lifestyle campaign, like the old Apple ad about shattering Big Brother or the Nike spot set to the Beatles' Revolution. While internet billionaires like Larry Page, Sergey Brin, and Mark Zuckerberg slam government surveillance, talk up freedom, and embrace Snowden and crypto privacy culture, their companies still cut deals with the Pentagon, work with the NSA and CIA and companies like Cambridge Analytica, and continue to track and profile people for profit. It's the same old split-screen marketing trick, the public branding, and the behind-the-scenes reality. Internet freedom is a win-win for everyone involved. Everyone, that is, except regular users who trust their privacy to double-dealing military contractors while powerful surveillance valley corporations continue to build out the old military cybernetic dream of a world where everyone is watched, predicted, and controlled. Indeed. And we'll come back and review some things and talk about some other aspects. The Internet of Things itself is going to be remarkable because now you've got cars, you've got refrigerators, thermostats, coffee makers, everything now hooked up to the Internet, and they don't have screens. You don't get updates. By the way, the CIA can make your car go 100 miles an hour and get you killed in a car wreck. So fun indeed. We're going to talk, too, about what happened to Yasha Levine when he broke this. He, again, knock-knock, is still alive and well, but boy, did he get savaged. And I can speak from experience that anyone who dares to suggest that maybe Snowden or WikiLeaks or Glenn Greenwald or any of the rest of these pieces of crap is less than a saint, well, believe me, you get hounded. However, that will come in another program, because this concludes For the Record program number 1080, Surveillance Valley Part 6, Double Agents Part 2, Foxes Guarding the Online Privacy Henhouse Part 3. This is being recorded on July 23rd of the year 2016. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.